Ladies and gentlemen, in just 1 minute, the ABC Radio Network and affiliated stations bring you an extraordinary address by the President of the United States before the Congress in an extraordinary joint session assembled in the chamber of the House of Representatives of the Capitol Building in Washington. In a surprise move about 2 hours ago, the White House announced that the President would address the Congress, and arrangements were hastily made up here on Capitol Hill to receive the Chief Executive. We are now awaiting the arrival of the President in the House chamber. Both houses convened at their regular time at 12 noon today, went through the opening preliminaries. Then at 12:04, the House was recessed to await the arrival of the members of the Senate and distinguished guests. And now here is doorkeeper Miller to announce the arrival of the President.
The President of the United States.
You have just heard the voice of doorkeeper Miller announcing the arrival of the President in the House chamber. Now the President is proceeding down the center aisle of the House chamber. The galleries are not very full today because of this surprise announcement. No one was expecting this move by the White House. And actually, the floor of the House is not as crowded as it usually is. The President is now shaking hands with the Vice President and Mr. McCormick of Massachusetts, who is here in the absence of Speaker Rayburn. The President is nodding to the right and to the left, opening his notes for his address, smiling. And now the House is called to order.
Members of the Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
The members have again risen to their feet and are giving the President an ovation. Again, he is smiling and nodding to the right and to the left, acknowledging it.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, I should like to report to the Congress on certain events that have happened in connection with the current dispute in the steel industry since I last communicated with the Congress on that subject. On April 9th, I informed the Congress that I had taken action to provide for temporary operation of the steel mills by the government. At that time, I indicated the reasons that had impelled me to take that action. I pointed out that the Congress might wish to take action providing for a different solution of the grave problem confronting the nation as a result of the steel dispute. I also said that if the Congress did not act, I would continue to do everything in my power to keep the steel industry operating and to bring about a settlement of the dispute. The Congress took no action accordingly. Government operation of the mills continued, and intensive efforts were made to bring the parties into agreement. Meetings between the parties were held from April 9th to April 15th, and on May 3rd and May 4th, but their differences on a number of issues were so great that no settlement could be reached. Meanwhile, some of the steel companies had instituted court proceedings for the purpose of challenging the President's power to keep the steel mills in operation. This case reached the Supreme Court on Monday, June 2nd. And on that day, a majority of that court decided that the President did not have the power in this instance to operate the mills. I immediately ordered that government possession of the mills be relinquished. On the same day, a strike was called, and most of the steel industry was shut down. Thus, the situation that I had sought to avoid was brought about. I had managed to keep steel production going from the end of December to the 2nd of June, a period of more than 150 days, even though the companies and the union had no collective bargaining contract. Now it had been made impossible for me to prevent a break in production. Very shortly thereafter, I was informed there was a reasonable prospect that the parties might be able to reach a settlement of their dispute if they could be brought together again to negotiate. I've said repeatedly that the ultimate and proper settlement of this matter can be achieved only by agreement between the parties. Consequently, I have sought at every opportunity to help bring about such an agreement. That, obviously, was the step that was called for in the circumstances prevailing last week. Moreover, it seemed essential that the negotiations be given every possible chance to succeed, that no other action be taken which would be likely to make either party unwilling or unable to negotiate in good faith. That is the course that was followed. The parties were called back into negotiations. They met from Thursday, June 5th, until Monday, June 9th. Although they made some progress, they were not able to reach a final agreement. We are now, therefore, faced with the necessity of using some other means for getting the steel mills back into production. When the negotiations were broken off last night, representatives of the parties indicated that they would cooperate in assuring production of military requirements essential to our forces engaged in combating communist aggressors. This morning, I have instructed Dr. Steelman, Acting Director of Defense Mobilization, and Mr. Lovett, the Secretary of Defense, to arrange with the companies and the union to meet as many of our urgent military requirements as possible under this pledge. It is impossible to determine at this time just how much steel can be obtained in this manner. We should be able to meet our most critical military needs. But at the same time, we cannot expect to get enough steel in this way to meet all the essential needs of the defense program. The fact is that we need steel not just for immediate combat requirements, but also for equipping all our armed forces and to help equip those of our allies. We need steel for constructing defense plants and new atomic energy installations. There are vital industrial requirements for steel, for such items as power generating equipment, freight cars, and oil producing equipment. These needs are very urgent and must not be indefinitely delayed by a steel shutdown. Our national security depends upon our total economic strength, and steel is the basic element in that strength. Consequently, we are faced with the imperative need for getting most, if not all, of the nation's steel mills back into production very promptly. There are several possible courses of action that might be followed. However, I believe there are two main possibilities. One of these is government operation of the steel mills. The other is the use of a labor injunction of the type authorized by the Taft-Hartley Law. The Congress can choose either of these two courses. I cannot. I could only use the Taft-Hartley approach. In my judgment, that is by far the worst of the two approaches. Consequently, I feel that I should put the facts before the Congress, recommend the course of action I deem best, and call upon the Congress, which has the power to do so, to make the choice. I believe the Congress should make its choice with a view of bringing about three objectives. First, to secure essential steel production. Second, to assure fair treatment to both parties in accordance with sound price and wage stabilization policies. Third, to encourage the parties to settle their differences through collective bargaining. Each of these objectives is important to the national interest, and the Congress should act to serve all of them. I believe the course which is most likely to achieve these objectives is to enact legislation authorizing the government to take over the steel plants and to operate them temporarily until the parties reach a settlement. This is the course I recommend. A seizure law, if properly drafted, can achieve the objectives of assuring steel production, treating both parties fairly, and encouraging collective bargaining. The key requirement of such a law, if it is to accomplish these ends, is to provide for fair and just compensation to the owners for the use of their property during a seizure and fair and just compensation for the work of the employees. The Constitution protects the owners of property during a period of government operation by requiring that they be given just compensation, and they can appeal to the courts to enforce that requirement. The law should give similar protection to wage earners. This means that changes in wages and working conditions during seizure should not be prevented by law. If they were, the seizure would mean that workers would be compelled to work indefinitely without a change in wages, no matter how much a change might be justified. This is obviously not equal justice under the law. In order to be fair, the law must provide for a method of determining just compensation for the owners and the workers during the period of government operations. This can be done by the establishment of special boards to work out specific proposals for the purpose within the general framework of the government's stabilization policies. In this way, the legislation can assure continued steel production and fair treatment for both parties during government operations. Seizure should not, of course, be regarded as a means of determining the issues in dispute between management and the union. Those issues will have to be settled by the parties through their own collective bargaining. Legislation providing for government operation will not prevent collective bargaining. As a matter of fact, the type of legislation I have described will undoubtedly increase the incentives for the parties to settle their differences through bargaining. The companies will face the possibility of receiving something less than their normal profits as just compensation, and the workers will face the prospect of getting less than they think they are entitled to. Indeed, I made this plain on May 3rd when I informed the parties that government changes in wages and working conditions would not be satisfactory to either side. I therefore recommend that the Congress promptly enact seizure legislation, such as I've described, which will restore full-scale steel production, provide fair treatment for all concerned, and maintain incentives for both parties to reach agreement on the disputed issues through collective bargaining. There's another course which the Congress could follow. That would be to enact legislation authorizing and directing the President to seek an injunction of the type authorized under the Taft-Hartley Act, but without going through the formality of appointing a board of inquiry and waiting for its report. I do not recommend that the Congress adopt the Taft-Hartley approach. I think it would be unwise, unfair, and quite possibly ineffective. The nation has already had the benefit of whatever could be gained by action under the Taft-Hartley Act. That act provides for two main things. It provides for a fact-finding board to investigate and report on the issues in dispute. In the steel case, we have already had the facts fully determined and reported by the Wage Stabilization Board. The Taft-Hartley Act also provides for injunctions against a shutdown for a total of 80 days. In the steel case, the union already, even before April 8th, had voluntarily postponed strike action for 99 days. Insofar as fact-finding and delay are concerned, therefore, the practical effects of the Taft-Hartley Act were achieved, in this case, some time ago. Over and above these facts, however, there are other compelling reasons for not using an injunction of the Taft-Hartley type in the steel case. Its effect would be to require the workers to continue working for another long period without change in their wages and working conditions. This would be grossly unfair. The Wage Stabilization Board, the government agency charged with the responsibility for these matters, has found and the companies have admitted that the workers are entitled to improvements in wages and working conditions. The union members stayed at work at the government request during the period the case was being considered by the Wage Board, and later during the period of government operation from April 8th to June 2nd. In these respects, the union and its members have cooperated fully with the government in the public interest.